Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
City Budget Day. We had the provincial budget last week, the federal budget this week. City budget today. If you are not feeling tapped out by the tax increases, well, I don't know if we can find any other budgets for you to deal with. We've done with them now. But today, City Council voting to pass a budget that was reduced. It was supposed to be 6.7%. That's what it came into the day as. Got down to 5.85%. And then the votes. In the end, voting yes on the budget, Andrea Horvath, Maureen Wilson, Cameron Crutch, Narinder Nan, Tammy Wang, Esther Paul, John Paul Danko, Craig Kassar, Alex Wilson, and Ted McMeekin voting no on the budget, Matt Francis, Tom Jackson, Brad Clark, Jeff Beattie, Mark Tattison, and Mike Spadafora. One of the people, who you just heard his name there, he voted yes ultimately on this one, but I know leading into this that there had been question. He was saying, anyway, that he had been uncertain about where he was going to go on this. Ward 8 Councillor John Paul Danko, who joins me now. Councillor, thank you for this.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So, maybe a month ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, you and I chatted, and you at that time had said you really were uncertain where you were going to go on this budget. You really weren't sure if you could support it. You ultimately voted yes. What made you decide that was the way to go?
I was undecided, and a number of my colleagues were also undecided up until about 1:30 yesterday afternoon. So I think what was different about this budget for me than the previous ones is before we would start at a number, and then we would work as a council to reduce that number, and we would get to a final budget that was lower than where we started. And this budget, it was going the opposite direction. We started at 5.4%, we reduced it a bit, and then somebody would add something, and all of a sudden it would be 6%, and then 6.5%. And we ended up at 6.7%, which was, as of yesterday, the budget that we would have passed. And I think a lot of my colleagues were feeling the exact same thing as me, that hearing from the residents that a 6.7% tax increase was just way too much, that it wasn't going to be accepted by residents. So, you know, we really had to sharpen the pencil. And through Mayor Horvath's leadership, we were able to work with staff, and she was able to identify an additional $10 million that was cut from the budget today. And that was, I think, enough to get us down below 6% to 5.8%. That gave us enough of a confidence that there is some financial responsibility here, and be able to pass a budget that we're not obviously happy about that level of tax increase, but that it's in line with inflation and it does include some really important services.
One of the things that could have happened today, when I look at the final vote, it was 10-6. However, you had been undecided, and I know that a few weeks ago, Esther Pauls had also said really not leaning towards voting yes. If the two of you had voted no, it would have been 8-8, which would have been a defeated budget. I don't think that's ever happened in the city of Hamilton before. It was that close to this being into new territory.
It's really unprecedented to have anything besides a unanimous budget, because we've spent months on this budget process working to this point. So usually by this point, there's unanimity around council that, yes, we all support the budget and, it's going to pass almost unanimous, if not unanimous. Like I said, this was a very different scenario where even today, some councillors were adding additional tax increase items or attempting to the budget. Thankfully, those were voted down. And I think that was the question for me, and speaking to a number of my colleagues, like I said, as of yesterday afternoon, this budget would have failed in its entirety. Thankfully, the mayor was able to step in and, through her leadership, provide some course forward that ultimately was supported.
That said, 5.85 is still much higher than it's been for a long, long time. Does this now become the norm? Does this become the thing that we get used to or even higher? I know that one of your colleagues, Cameron Crutch, was on Twitter before the budget came out, and it was a long string. But one of the things is, I think we will miss out on bold investments to address our changing climate, to improve transit substantially and create new services to provide supports to those living without housing, food, and water. But there's next year and the year after that. That's a that almost sounds like get ready, because we didn't get to spend a lot now, but that's what I'm reading it, that we can do that next year or the year after. Is this now the norm?
That's my concern. And I think looking forward, when we're seeing some of the provincial downloading, we're seeing some of the pressures, in particular areas like asset management and infrastructure, where there are enormous budget pressures coming. You know, my biggest concern is that, and this was shared today as well, that future years are going to be, you know, instead of starting at 2-3%, we'll be starting at, you know, 5.8, 5.9. And that becomes the norm. And I think that's not acceptable for me. I think that's not acceptable for, I hope, the majority of council. But I think, you know, it takes some time to kind of, as a new council, really understand what your priorities and your strategic directions are. We're working on that now. And I'm hopeful that future budgets, there'll be a little bit more balance between, well, this is the thing that we want to do, we think it's right, and the ability of taxpayers to pay, you know, for those services. Because in Hamilton, that is one of the biggest issues that we have, is that income rates in Hamilton are lower than our comparators. And, you know, we really do have to consider the ability of our residents to actually pay these increases, because at the end of the day, they're the ones that that are, you know, faced with the bill.
Well, and thank you for saying that, because one of the things that I think seems to get lost in this is when somebody says, well, it's just $300 per household what this increase is, that's fine, but it's not in a vacuum. That's not just, it's not like we have a $1,000 tax and we're adding $300 this year and then we go back to where we were. That $300 is added to the money that was added last year, and then next year will be added to that $300 again. So it's not, saying it's just $300 is not really fair. It's not really accurate to what people are being tagged with.
No, it's not. And it's also the number of employees that are added. So I think today we added more than 45 full-time staff members. As Councillor Francis pointed out, that's more full-time staff members than all of last term added to the budget. You know, and once those employees are employed by the City of Hamilton, they're unionized, and, you know, they just carry over from year to year. So when we're adding staff, when we're adding those rates, and it is misleading when you're only looking at, oh, well, you know, for the average household, it's only, you know, this much of an increase. But then next year's an increase, and the year after that's an increase. And that's where it becomes a cumulative effect. And at the end of the day, if you're a senior on a fixed income, you know, an increase of $300 can mean that you're going to be able to remain in your house or not.
Well, and again, that $300 for this year may not be a thing, but you've got a four-year term. At this rate, that's 1,200, 4 years from now, that means the increase is $1,200 a year. Now you're getting into real money.
Yeah, and again, I think that's, for some of us, that's our biggest concern, is that we're kind of setting the new normal. And I would feel a lot better about this budget if I didn't think that future years were going to be as high or if not more. But the fact is that the challenges that we're facing as a city right now with housing and homelessness, we just had a report that, you know, just to address housing and homelessness would cost an extra, I think it was $30 to $60 million a year. All those pressures are still there next year, along with provincial downloading, along with new pressures that we might not even know about now. And the fact is, you know, the taxpayers are at their limit right now, that, you know, they can't afford to put gas in the car, they can't afford groceries. And then adding on to that, I think we need a little bit more, you know, consideration of what this means to the taxpayers that pay our salaries.
It is 5.85%. As I say, it works out to about $260 this year. But keep in mind, that's a cumulative thing now. That will keep building. John Paul Danka, Ward 8 Councillor, thanks for doing this today. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We had a report that came out in the city late last week, and it was about discipline, really. Discipline suspensions at Hamilton Public Schools. The Hamilton Wentworth District School Board announced that there was a sharp rise in 20-day suspensions for all kinds of things, from weapon possession, sexual assault, physical assault, incidents motivated by prejudice, hate, bias.
And I think most people reading that would say, that's not good. Doesn't sound like things are going particularly well in schools. Well, the school board talked this up to better training of principals and vice principals. And yet when you realize that we are talking about hundreds of these cases, hundreds of kids who are being suspended, whether it's because of better training or whatever, you do have to ask yourself, what is going on? Paul Bennett is the director of Schoolhouse Institute. He is Canada's leading educational expert. He joins me now. Paul, you've written about this. You've been talking about this for some time now. This is not just Hamilton, but this is something that's going on all across the country.
Everywhere you look across Canada, there's an outbreak of violence. It spiked after the pandemic, and we're beginning to see what I describe as the bitter harvest of 2 or 3 years of disrupted education. It's manifested in violent acts. And as I've written and talked about across the country, it's as simple as this. Fists and knives are more prevalent in schools than ever before. And it seems to have been accentuated and made worse by the pandemic disruptions.
The story says, the report says overall 3,902 students were suspended in 2021-22. It's a staggering number. When I was in school, there were suspensions. There's no question. I don't want you or I to be just sitting here as the old men, but there were suspensions. People did stuff wrong. The numbers, though, there was never like this. I guess the question is it really more bad discipline? Is it really more problems, or is it a less tolerance for it? So we're just suspending people more.
The irony is that's not supposed to be happening. Since 2008, your province, Ontario, led the country in abolishing what is called zero tolerance policies, with an explicit commitment to reducing suspensions and expulsions. And I've tracked the pattern across the country, well, across the province and then the country. And from 2008 on to 2019, there was a dramatic decrease in suspensions. I will say this, that your one school district there, the Hamilton-Wentworth School District, has always had more suspensions than other places. That is borne out in the data. So what you're seeing is an anomaly. You would be shocked at how few suspensions there are in some of those other jurisdictions. And here's what I've learned in studying this over quite a few years, is you have to really critically examine data of that type, because there are huge variations in the application of student discipline policies.
Well, and certainly in this area, people here will remember there was a child, it was a tragic, tragic story, Devin Selvey, who was stabbed, a student outside a school. And there was allegations, there was talk, not even allegations, there was bullying involved. And you wonder, has that simply made people at the schools far more sensitive to these kind of things, so actions are much more likely to be taken than there would be necessarily someone where something like this hasn't happened?
Scott, I think there's a simpler explanation. The Hamilton-Wentworth Board is the board that's most inclined to suspend students and is not representative of the others. What's going on is, it's more typical of what's going on in, say, Thames Valley Board in London in particular, where everyone, including the ETFO, President Craig Smith, and others are saying that the discipline is too soft. The teachers are tired of reporting kids to the office. Nothing happens, and are very critical of what is called the soft discipline approach. And it's called soft progressive discipline. So what has been really happening across the country is the spike of post-COVID violence has exposed just how ineffective the student behavior policy and practices are. And you know what's fascinating? After 15 years, whether the suspensions are up or not, it's time to reevaluate the student behavior policies in Ontario, because they're not working. Whether kids are being suspended in huge numbers, or whether teachers are afraid to report these suspensions, or whether parents are being told that they're exaggerating. Here's what Sarah Murray was told in Ottawa after her son was beaten up and came home with kneed in the head, and he kept it quiet. And she said, "What's wrong with you?" And she called the school, and the answer was, "Well, we don't want to talk about that because it would be a traumatic experience." So more common out there is a school system's covering this up. But I will say this, since I wrote the front page piece in the National Post, believe it or not, it was a month ago, it appeared on the front page of the National Post, blazing headlines. Culture of silence has been broken. I've personally tracked about 10 or 15 major stories everywhere. And then the stabbing at C.P. Allen High School down here, the biggest story, it ended up on CNN, Reuters. It's all of a sudden, everyone's talking about violence in schools. So it's not exclusively Hamilton, but I would say that your particular situation is a little different than others.
And the flip side of this, so some people might say, well, Hamilton sounds out of control. The flip side you could take, I suppose, is there's a lot of people who would say, as you've just alluded to, for a long time, it seems teachers have been unable to do anything. I mean, and no one's proposing bringing back the strap or something, but that teachers have been essentially helpless. You can't do anything about this. Well, at least here, you've got a school board that is saying, no. If you're going to misbehave, we're going to send you home and we're going to suspend you. Some people might say that's a great thing.
Well, I can tell you that there are a lot of secondary school teachers in Ontario who wish they were in a board like that, because the reverse is the pattern they're
right, right.
They're under a lot of stress. And even, you know, when you get Craig Smith, who's the leader of the elementary teachers union in Thames Valley, he says it's gone too far. This pendulum has swung. Now kids are free to do anything they want. They feel liberated to basically call out a teacher, swear at them. They punch in class. There's all kinds of concealed weapons. This is what's going on. In Toronto, in fact, the administrators have come out in concert and saying that violence is running wild in the Toronto school system. So I think the reverse is true in other places. And I think you probably, as a Hamiltonian, you probably think, well, you know, I don't think you deviated as much from the traditional approaches as some of these other boards. Now, having said that, my colleague, Tracy Viancourt, is the leading expert on teen mental health and bullying in Canada. She's at the University of Ottawa. And she and I agree on this, that, you know, we need more parental, we need more adult eyes on what's going on in schools. But it's common knowledge in secondary schools in Ontario and elsewhere that washrooms are dangerous places.
Mm. It's a we got to run. It's a stunning thing for me anyway. When I see the numbers, 3,900 students suspended. And again, you can say, well, that's good that the school board and the schools are cracking down. And I would actually agree with that. I would think that it's good that the schools are saying we're not going to take it. But the fact that they would need to have suspensions for 3,900 offenses in school, as I say, when we were back in school and it wasn't all that long ago, boy, it seems like times have really changed. Paul Bennett. From the Schoolhouse Institute. Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
You probably know that tomorrow evening, Thursday evening, the Blue Jays get their season going. Spring is here. We have arrived at spring, which is a lovely thought, even though it may not feel exactly that way. But let's talk a little bit of baseball, because last year at this time, we were told, we believed that, as I think Vladimir Guerrero Jr. said, that we had seen the preview. Now it was time for the main event. Well, we didn't quite see the main event. Is this year for the Blue Jays going to be the main event? Mike Wilner, columnist with the Toronto Star, podcast host, we'll hear about that in a few minutes, joins us now. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing all right, thanks. How are you?
I am great. But as for the fans out there, let's go to that question first. Is this year when we are going to see the main event? Is this the year that it comes together for the Blue Jays?
Well, I mean, they should be in the playoffs again. I think they're going to win the division, but you know, baseball is as much as people say the Stanley Cup is the hardest trophy to win, and it is for the grind of it. Baseball, the World Series is the toughest to win because there's just so much randomness in baseball, and so many teams are separated by such small margins. So, we should all be very disappointed if the Blue Jays don't make the playoffs, because they're clearly one of the top six teams in the AL at least, if not one of the top two or three. But beyond that is a coin flip. Once you get in, you've got about the same chance as everybody else. And the Phillies and Padres showed that last year. So, you know, when Vlad said last year was a preview, this year's the movie, we got a pretty good movie. They made it to the playoffs, and then it stunk after that.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes the sequel's better than the original.
Well, the other thing, and it's to your point, I think, about how baseball is just, it's so unknown. I don't know. I mean, the Yankees coming into last season, I don't know how many people said they were going to be an absolute powerhouse. I think people thought they did. You thought they were, because it was
I can tell you how many people thought they were going to be an absolute powerhouse. Nobody.
Yeah, they were. Consensus, they were okay.
Right. The consensus was the Yankees were going to finish third and be on the bubble for the playoffs, and then, you know, they were on a 120 win pace in the second week of July.
And so when you look at that, you say that's the random. I don't know if random is the right word, because it's not exactly out of people's control, but it's the unpredictability of baseball, that if things start to go really right, it can go really right. If things don't go really right, it can go very wrong. The Blue Jays, though, seem to, again, have the pieces that at least the possibility is there for things to go Yankees-like, as in last year for the Yankees.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a special, special thing, right? It doesn't happen very often where a team is so good for 2 or 3 months that they absolutely just run away with things. You know, the Tigers, we still talk about the Tigers.
84. Yeah, 84.
Right, 84, where they were 35-5, because it happens so rarely. The Yankees outdid the Tigers last year, not just over the first 40 games. They weren't 35-5, but again, they were still on a record pace for single season wins in July, winning more than 75% of their games. So that's an exceptionally rare thing that happens when a team will run away and hide with a good division. I don't think they're going to do that. I think that they're going to, you know, it's as exciting as a good team is, and this is a very good team, and I'm picking them to win the AL East. You know, we still have to remember that, if you win six times and lose four times out of every 10 games, that's 98 wins, right? That's an amazing season. And you're still losing 4 out of 10. So, it feels to me, and maybe it's from years of hosting the post game show. It feels to me that people expect that when a team is really good, they're going to win every game,
right,
or they're going to win most games, or they're going to win, you know, 4 out of 5 games, and that just doesn't happen. So yeah, no matter how good they are, they're going to lose some games. You're not going to turn it on and it's going to be 6-0 in the fourth inning every night, and they're going to roll to 130 wins. But they are going to be very, very good.
And I don't want to sound, you know, I don't want to sound fanboyish, but I mean, it just, the things that they have, if things go their way, I guess is what I was saying, like with the comparison to the Yankees, they have the people, it seems, that if they produce like they have the potential to produce, this team could be really good. I mean, Kikuchi is an example. I mean, disaster last year, has looked great in spring, which means absolutely nothing, although it's better than looking terrible in the spring, I suppose.
Yep.
But, you know, he continues this into the season, man, there's a huge change from last year. If Jose Barrios can find something again, as opposed to being the disaster he was last year, there's something that, and has the potential to, certainly, there's something. If Gausman and Manoah can continue doing what they did last year, like the pieces are there that this thing could be really good.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, no, the pieces are there that this thing should be really good. That's the difference. You know, we've had so many years of Blue Jay watching where if this goes well and if this happens and if everybody stays healthy and if, then they have a chance to contend for a playoff spot. This team is they're a playoff team, period. And if Kikuchi holds on to this and if Barrios bounces back, then they're going to win 105 games. That's the difference. If Kikuchi and Barrios had terrible years last year, although it should be noted that the Blue Jays won more games that Jose Barrios started than they did with any other starting pitcher on the mound. And that's not just because they bailed him out all the time. They bailed him out a couple of times, but it's because 2/3 of his starts were really good. The 1/3 of his starts that were not really good were just abysmal. And that led to those horrible numbers. But, you know, even with Kikuchi and Barrios both being two of the worst starting pitchers in the league last year, they were the top wildcard team, right? They mm-hmm. finished with 92 wins and had the third best record in the league for almost the entire season. Cleveland passed them, I think, with like 4 days to go. So all that stuff went wrong and they still won 92 games. And, you know, now they have an incredibly better defense, which is going to lead to the pitchers being a lot better. And I think at the end of the season, a lot of people will just say, hey, wow, those pitchers really had way better years and won't realize how many singles and doubles Dalton Varsho and Kevin Kiermaier took away, how many times they kept runners from going first to third or stopped runners from scoring from first on doubles. And it'll be that quiet contribution that doesn't show up in the box score except in the pitcher's ERAs and the one loss record. But this is a team that, you know, even if Barrios and Kikuchi have terrible years again, so they win 92 again instead of winning 98.
Something that a lot has been made of this spring has been the attitude around the team and things, for example, like the home run jacket going away and Teoscar Hernandez being traded. Maybe, you know, some say not the most serious guy. Maybe the Blue Jays needed to be more focused, more serious, less just fun. Do you make anything of that? Does that make any real difference or is that just a personality change and whatever?
I wonder if it's more about John Schneider having the team now and running camp the way he wants to run it and bringing in guys like Belt and Kiermaier. You know, I'm less, you know, people sort of concentrate on what happened in the corner of the dugout and the barrio with Guerrero and Gurriel and Teoscar Hernandez all just having a good time together all the time. I don't see anything wrong with that. The issue for me was that there was a lack of focus on the field sometimes from Gurriel and Hernandez. We saw the occasional brain lock, you know, the trying to make a hero throw or throwing to the wrong base or just whiffing on a fly ball or something like that. There was more often than there should have been, there was a lack of court awareness from those two, from Gurriel and Hernandez. I don't think they had to go, but I do think bringing in Kiermaier and Varsho and bringing in Brandon Belt really help, and having Whit Merrifield for a whole year really help. A focus on the little things. Kiermaier's got World Series experience. Belt's won two World Series. Varsho's dad was a manager in the major leagues. You know, I think that's the more important stuff than the throwing sunflower seeds around and hanging out in the corner of the dugout and laughing all the time. I don't buy into the whole mentality that when you're losing in a game, you should look angry on the bench. That doesn't help with anything. Stay loose and stay relaxed and you can come back and win a ball game.
You've talked about the defense and it's a huge point and the pitching and that kind of thing that's going to help. One of the one of the things that we haven't seen, maybe you have, I don't know if you've been down to the dome as these renovations have been going on, but I mean, the dimensions are going to change a bit. There's talk that, you know, it's going to be, it's already a hitter's park, that it's going to be a little easier potentially even for hitters. Does that, so when you're working, when you're a team that has added to your defense and added to your pitching, and then the dimensions maybe become a little easier for hitters, does that help the Jays net or does that hurt the Jays net?
I think it helps because they're a power hitting team, right? I think that bringing the fences in as they have, I've seen the early construction, and I guess next week we'll go see it before the place opens, before the home opener. It's going to be the wall's going to be higher where the fence is shorter. So only those like really high fly balls that got caught at the warning track are going to wind up going out. But I think there are going to be a few more of those. Matt Chapman, I can remember, hit a bunch of warning track flyouts, and those are going to be homers or doubles now. But not a lot of this, not a lot of these guys hit wall scrapers, right? They were full measure for most of their home runs. The new nooks and crannies, well, not so much nooks and crannies, but weird angles and curved walls and strange bounces. Having great outfielders is going to help with that a lot. I think anytime you improve your outfield defense to the extent that the Blue Jays have, I mean, this is the best defensive outfield this team has ever had in its history. And it's the best defensive outfield in baseball. So in a vacuum, anytime you do that, you're getting a lot better. But you're also adding a bunch of home runs, and you know, for as many home runs as they'll lose with Teoscar Hernandez, they'll match them with Dalton Varsho. Varsho hit 27 last year playing in Arizona, which is a neutral offensive ballpark, leaning pitcher friendly. But he was also in the NL West, where, you know, Dodger Stadium, San Francisco, San Diego, they're all caverns. So his home run numbers are going to pump up. So, you know, I think in the overall, all the changes total will result in a net positive.
You are saying this is the best defensive outfield, better than when George Bell played, better than when Candy Maldonado played, better than when Mookie Wilson was out there.
It's interesting that you would bring up George Bell and Candy Maldonado. Neither of them were good.
I was trying to think of who were the worst fielders I could think of over the course of time, but I mean,
Mookie was all right.
He was old by the time he got here. He was you know, yeah. He was a decent player, but
he can still move. People think of Bell, Barfield, and Mosby as like the greatest outfield that the Blue Jays have ever had, and it was offensively. George Bell was a terrible left fielder. You know, they've never had a group of three that's this good. They've got three center fielders playing in the outfield now, two of whom are among the best defensive players in the game, in Varsho and Kiermaier. And I'm interested to see what Springer looks like in a corner, but it is absolutely the best defensive outfield they've ever put together.
One of the other big stories, and I know it's been talked about over the spring, but mostly it's been talked about, and talking about the pitch clock, mostly it's been talked about by weird things that happen where the batter isn't quite ready yet or whatever. But this is going to, I would think, as the year goes on, I mean, baseball's the grind, we talk about it, and you get into the dog days, the really hot days of summer, this is potentially going to have an impact on pitchers. Do you not think that there are going to be guys that really excel with this, that it gets them going and keeps them moving and gets their rhythm going, and other guys that it wears them out?
I don't know that it's going to really wear anybody out. I think that over time, I think we'll discover, and you know, look, you work in radio. I worked in radio forever. Over time, we'll discover just how long 20 seconds is, because 20 seconds can be an awfully long time. 8 seconds can be an awfully long time. From the point of time where the hitter has to be alert to the pitcher with 8 seconds on the clock, those 8 seconds can take forever. So I think pitchers will get used to that. They'll learn that. They'll find a rhythm, and they'll be fine. I think with some of them, I believe it's already helped Kikuchi. You know, he's talked about that too. He doesn't have as much time to think as he used to. He just has to go get the ball and pitch. And it's really, it's not that much of a rush, but sort of does keep you on task a little bit. So I think it's going to help more than it hurts in the overall for pitchers and for hitters.
Do you like it? Having seen it, do you like it generally?
Oh, God, I love it. It's like I don't understand how anyone can have an issue with it. And I hear all these old men yelling at cloud saying, this is a game, the only game that's never out of clock. But this, it's not a clock like football or hockey or basketball. You still have to get 27 outs. There's no running out the clock when you have a lead. It's just the fact that you have to throw the damn ball and you have to get in the box. And, it's funny that so many of the older fans are upset about it, because what it does is it takes baseball back to where it was 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. 100%.
When people didn't screw around so much and when games were over in 230 or 240. The beauty of it is you're not losing any baseball. There is no baseball that has been lost with the addition of this pitch timer. What you're losing is hitters calling timeout after every pitch to adjust their gloves and adjust their belt and kick dirt out of their cleats and adjust their helmet, and hitters taking a minute and a half to walk up so they can listen to their walk-up music, and pitchers stalking around the mound for an hour or throwing over to first base seven times. All that's gone, and that's wonderful because none of that was needed. It really is good. And honestly, I've seen, I don't know, I was down there for a week here, 5 days there, so I was probably at 8 or 9 games in spring training, and 3 or 4 of them were like, man, this thing is really dragging. And they wound up being 245. Mm. So it changes your perspective in a hurry.
One thing I really hope that it changes or brings back, and it may, or, you know, coaches tend to figure things out, and you know, we've seen it in hockey a million times. They change the rules, and for a brief time, everything is wide open. You go, man, this is great. And then the coaches discover how to stifle it. I really hope that the fact that pitchers now have to get the ball moving brings the stolen base back into the game a lot more than it has been for the last couple decades.
Well, it will, I think. I think the bigger bags will help because it's now like 6 to 8 inches closer to get to from base to base. And the fact that pitchers can only throw over twice during an at-bat. If they can throw a third time, but they better pick you off. Otherwise, it's a balk. So that cat and mouse game is going to change quite a bit. I don't think we're going to see anybody steal 100 bases anymore. I think that the math has been done on what that does to your body and how much of a toll it takes. But I do think we're definitely going to see, I mean, maybe even twice as many stolen base attempts as we've seen in the recent past.
Which is great, because that's sort of a dying art. I mean, we don't need Ricky Henderson or Tim Raines, but I mean, it's just be nice to have that back in play. Mike Wilner, not only a columnist with the Toronto Star, also the Deep Left Field podcast. That's still going on this year?
Of course it's still going on this year. It's bigger, badder, and better than ever.
Excellent. Where will people find that? Because I know they'll want to. Where do people find the Deep Left Field podcast?
I guess, I mean, wherever you get your podcasts. If you have an iPhone, you've got a podcast icon on it. Just click on that and search Deep Left Field, or go to, I don't quite know how it works on Androids, but you can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Apple Podcasts. Yeah, wherever finer podcasts are available. And this episode coming out on Thursday, the opening day extravaganza, we will have Alec Manoa and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and George Springer, Jordan Romano, and Danny Jansen. They're all going to be on this week. So it's a pretty amazing episode.
Mike Wilner, always appreciate you doing this. Thanks for it.
You bet. Anytime.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.